You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Affirmative action is at its core, says Randall Kennedy about race. And it is a kind of discrimination, he tells us, positive discrimination, meant to correct a long history of racial inequity. In his new book, For Discrimination, Race, Affirmative Action, and the Law, Kennedy walks us through the history of affirmative action in the United States. He reminds us that with the abolition of slavery only a year old, President Andrew Johnson was already claiming that blacks and their allies were seeking racial favoritism. He describes the relationship between affirmative action and the 14th Amendment, explores who have been its persistent critics, and what president, surprisingly, went furthest in advancing policies that reached beyond mere anti-discrimination norms. His new book, which begins on a personal note, is both illuminating and coolly reasoned. It's been hailed as the definitive reckoning with one of the most explosively contentious and sharply divisive issues in American society. Kennedy was awarded the 1998 Robert F. Kennedy Book Award for Race, Crime, and the Law. He is now a professor of law at Harvard Law School, and he formerly served as a law clerk for Justice Thurgood Marshall of the United States Supreme Court. He's also the author of Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word, and The Persistence of the Color Line, Racial Politics and the Obama Presidency. As moderator, I have the great pleasure of welcoming back Erwin Chemerinsky, who is the founding dean of the University of California Irvine School of Law. Erwin has authored 7 books and more than 200 law review articles and has argued cases before the Supreme Court and various circuits of the United States Court of Appeals. His most recent book, which he discussed here at Aloud, is The Conservative Assault on the Constitution. It is an honor. Please join me in welcoming Randall Kennedy and Erwin Chemerinsky to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Good evening. It's such an honor and pleasure to be with you this evening. This is a great personal pleasure for me. I've read Randy Kennedy's works for years with great admiration. We've corresponded by email, even talked by the phone, but this is the first time we've had the chance to meet in person. It's also a great pleasure because this gave me the occasion to get an advanced copy of For Discrimination, and I so enjoyed reading it. Just today, I was recommending it to someone. I think the place to start, though, Randy, is why did you write this book?
Well, I write about racial conflict and legal institutions, and certainly the affirmative action controversy has given rise to a lot of conflict. I didn't have to emphasize that to an audience living here in California. I also wanted to write about affirmative action because over the past few years, affirmative action has been so vilified. And I wanted to write a defense of it. And one of the reasons why I wanted to write a defense of it is because it has been so important in my own life. I begin the book with an introduction in which I talk about my own encounters with the race line. I'm from the Deep South. I'm from Columbia, South Carolina. And I was born in 1954. I saw the end of the Jim Crow era. And I've seen some very terrible things with respect to the race line, and I talk about those. Later on in my life, I benefited tremendously from the affirmative action ethos. I benefited tremendously from individuals and from institutions that reached out a helping hand to advance the fortunes of black people for a variety of reasons. And I wanted to applaud those efforts and to explain those efforts and to show why those efforts have made our country a better country over the past several decades. So those are some of the reasons why I wanted to write this book.
When we were talking before coming out here, we were each talking about what classes we're teaching, and you were telling me that you teach a year-long course, basically two semesters, on the history of race in the United States. The first chapter of your book tells the history of affirmative action. From that, what lessons overall would you draw from what you tell about the current affirmative action debate?
Well, one thing, this debate, many people think, is a relatively recent debate. So many people will, you know, if you talk about affirmative action, they'll think, well, this is something that began in the late 1960s, the early 1970s, and they'll focus on that. So it's a modern debate. And one of the things I try to show is that actually this is a debate that's quite old. And so let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. We now hear the term reverse discrimination, and I think many people would think that reverse discrimination is a relatively recent addition to the lexicon of American race relations. But I point out that I give an example of how this is the idea of reverse discrimination really is long been with us. So one example, let's look at the nation's first civil rights law. First federal civil rights law. The nation's first federal civil rights law was the Civil Rights Act of 1866. The Civil Rights Act of 1866 was an act that made all persons born in the United States citizens of the United States. And it's also an act that provided that all persons would have the same rights as white people to enter into contracts, to own property, to testify, to sue, to be sued, the classic civil rights.
And if I can just interject, key parts of that law remain on the books to this day.
Absolutely.
Major civil rights statutes that are used in litigation all the time.
The Civil Rights Act of 1866 used day in and day out. Very important statute. But it was vetoed. It was vetoed by Abraham Lincoln's successor. President Andrew Johnson vetoed the Civil Rights Act of 1866. Why? He vetoed it because it gave, quote, discriminating protection to the Negro. He said this was an act that discriminated against white people. How did it discriminate against white people? Well, he said the Civil Rights Act of 1866 would elevate to citizenship all of the former slaves. Whereas white people coming from, Europe had to wait 7 years to become naturalized citizens of the United States. They were being discriminated against. He said, with respect to owning, with the civil rights, he said, the federal government has never acted previously to protect anyone's civil rights. Why is it doing so now? It's showing racial favoritism. Now, mind you, this is in 1866. The abolition of slavery is 1 year old. And I give examples. This is one example, but actually you can go back even before the abolition of slavery. There were slaveholders who attacked abolitionists, saying that they're wanting to abolish slavery. What they were really after was putting blacks over whites. If next year, next summer, that we will celebrate the 50th year of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, when the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was being debated 50 years ago, the staunchest opponents of that act said that that act would necessarily lead to reverse discrimination. So my point is, this tendency to see reverse discrimination in anything advancing the fortunes of people of color is a deep-seated tendency, a deep-seated instinct.
You know, you're talking about next summer being the 60th anniversary, the 50th anniversary of the 91st Rights Act. Next May will be the 60th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education. Brown versus Board of Education was decided May 17th, 1954. So there's two very important anniversaries in the history of civil rights to be celebrated in the coming year. What do you think is the strongest argument in favor of affirmative action today? Your book reviews all of the arguments, but if I was to say to you, what's the strongest argument that you would make in favor of it? Where do you come out?
Well, two.
Okay.
Two. I'm not going to... If you're arguing at the Supreme Court, so, you know, last year, the Supreme Court was considering an affirmative action plan at the University of Texas. And if you were a lawyer arguing before the Supreme Court, the argument that you would focus on would be the so-called diversity argument. And that argument dates from around 1978, and in fact, it dates from a California case, University of California, Davis Medical School versus Bakke. That was the case in which racial affirmative action was first upheld by the Supreme Court of the United States. And the key opinion in that case was crafted by Justice Lewis Powell. And he said that racial affirmative action would be allowed on grounds of diversity, the idea being that educational institutions would be better institutions if they brought to the table, brought to the campuses, people from different, you know, with different races, different religions, different ideological backgrounds. He said, under those circumstances, if you're trying to create a rich educational environment, race could be taken into account in order to do that. It turns out that the Supreme Court has really whittled things down, so that's virtually the only argument that you can make. And so for, you know, on pragmatic grounds, I would say, well, if that's the only argument you can make, make that argument. I think there's something to the diversity argument, but I think it's a mistake to think that that's the only rationale that can suitably justify affirmative action. I think there are a wide range of other rationales. One of them, I think a very powerful one, the one that really animated affirmative action in the late 1960s, the early 1970s, was the idea that it was a moral imperative to intervene and try to redress the ongoing consequences of past racial oppression. And I think that that argument is still a very powerful one. Yet another argument.
Let me pause at that one and ask a question, then I'll go back to the other one. Let me ask this. Doesn't that argument inevitably set up the response, why not focus on class rather than race? Because if what we're trying to do is redress the past wrongs, if we talk about an African-American child of a doctor who's gone to the fanciest private schools, why should that person get affirmative action to remedy past wrongs, as opposed to, say, a child who grew up in poverty, but on a farm, white parents? Doesn't the second argument really lead immediately saying, shouldn't affirmative action be on class rather than race?
Some people make that argument, but it might very well be, tragically, it might very well be that the poor kid, the kid, in fact, who the poor kid who has not had a good education might not be in a position, for instance, to go to college. He might have been so educationally disfigured that he is not in a position to really go to college. Now, you mentioned the argument about class. So let me just say it directly. I'm all for interventions that would assist people, poor people, no matter what. I mean, there are lots of poor white people in the United States, lots of them. And I'm all for assisting them. But in order to assist them, we don't need to get rid of racial affirmative action. We need to supplement racial affirmative action by other reformist measures. One thing, sometimes people, when they talk about class, not race, they make it seem as though class and race are fungible, as if they are the same. They're not. There is class oppression in the United States. There is class inequity in the United States. And sometimes it overlaps with racial oppression, but they are distinct. We need both.
But let me ask the question then about, imagine this hypothetical African-American child who grew up in a very wealthy family, parents were doctors and lawyers, went to the fanciest private schools. Why affirmative action that would benefit that child?
Fine. Affirmative action is not about any particular individual. It's not about just desserts for a particular individual. It's about changing our society. And it might very well be that the black child of Bill Cosby, that used to be the typical one, or now I suppose it would be the child of Barack Obama. In fact, Barack Obama was asked when he first ran for president, you know, what about affirmative action for your daughters? And he sort of backed off and made it seem as though it was a question of, you know, individual dessert for his daughters. It's not. It's not about his daughter. It's not about individual dessert. It's about how do we change our institutions of American life to make for a better country? It may very well be that the child of the black surgeon, the child of the black lawyer, is positioned to better assist our institutions with the sort of change that we, you know, want to make. Now, having said that, I think that you have put your finger on a limitation with affirmative action. You know, I'm for affirmative action. The name of my book is For Discrimination. I'm for affirmative action, but I would be the first to recognize that it is limited. It's limited. And one of its limitations, especially if we're talking about higher education, one of its limitations is its class bias. I mean, after all, if a student is a plausible candidate to get into one of the elite public universities or the professional schools of one of the elite public universities, if you're in a position to do that, you're pretty well off. I mean, if you're a plausible candidate, for instance, to get into the University of Michigan Law School, what does that mean? That means you've graduated from college. That means that you were a good college student. So you're going to do okay. And so one argument is, well, you know, why allocate a lot of energy trying to protect a social program that's going to help this kid? What about the poor kids in Detroit who don't even make it through high school? And what I say to that is, we definitely need to focus attention on the poor kids that don't make it through high school. We still need, however, affirmative action because the elite institutions of American life are still in need of a continuation of the desegregation that's been going on for the past 3 decades.
Let me ask you that. In the book, you talk about the left critique of affirmative action. Mm-hmm. And you say that part of that is that affirmative action has tended not to help the so-called legacy blacks, the African Americans who are descendant from slaves, that those who benefit most from affirmative action are often those who come from foreign countries but are of African descent. What's your response to that argument?
Some people have made a, you know, have posited that as a complaint. I think people need to be really very careful and recognize that programs can only be fine-tuned so much. I mean, you know, actually in the 1960s, when affirmative action was first being debated in the law reviews, one issue that was very, you know, seriously set forth, well, you know, how are we going to determine who's black? Right? I mean, you know, how do you determine who's black? And sometimes it is a complicated question. You know, I mean, it is. There are hundreds. I mean, in American history, there are thousands of cases in which that question has actually been litigated.
And not cases we want to go back to either.
And not cases we want to go back to. And I think what has happened in institutions over the past 40 years, there's been an unstated decision made that we're not going to police this. We're not going to go but so far in distinguishing who's black, who's not. So we're not going to ask, frankly, are you the descendants of slaves? Frankly, there are a lot of black people who probably don't know. And after all, you know, even before 1865, there was a cadre of free black people. There were some black people who owned other black people. You can only go so far before your policing of affirmative action becomes so unpleasant that it itself becomes a reason to reject it. So I tell people, affirmative action is like a lot of other policies. It has costs, it's under-inclusive, it's over-inclusive, it's blurry around the edges, but so is every program, and you can't fine-tune it but so much.
One of the things that Randy does so well in the book is identify the arguments against affirmative action and then respond to them. I want to focus on two that you discuss in the book. One is the stigma argument. And as you identify in the book, Clarence Thomas has made this argument that the problem with having affirmative action is it then creates a stigma that any time an African American or a Latino achieves, gets into a fancy school, gets a prestigious position, it's assumed because it's affirmative action. What's your response to that claim that comes, I say, from, among others, Justice Clarence Thomas?
Yeah, well, he makes a point. It's a good point. It is a cost. And I tell my friends who are, you know, in the pro-affirmative action camp that it's a mistake to act as if affirmative action doesn't have costs. It does have costs, and this is one of them. There is a stigmatic cost to affirmative action. I certainly feel it. I started my class at Harvard Law School 2 weeks ago. Every year I teach first-year contracts. And on the first day, I get up in front of 80 very ambitious, hard-charging, smart students, and I have no doubt that amongst the 80 students, there's some who, when I get up, are thinking the following. This guy Kennedy, is he a real Harvard Law School professor? Or is he okay, but a somewhat lesser professor than his colleagues because he's probably been, you know, bumped along through affirmative action? I have no doubt that that is, you know, in the audience. And, you know, is that a cost? Yeah, it's a cost, sure. It's a cost. And I think, frankly, it is probably a cost it's inevitable. I think it's just there. I don't think that you can have a design of affirmative action that can get rid of that. I think, however, that, you know, I chalk it up as a cost, and the question is, the benefits outweigh the cost. I think that the benefits do outweigh the cost.
Why?
Well, I mean, if you take a look at the benefits of affirmative action, if you ask, has affirmative action incentivized people who might have thought, gosh, there's really no use in me working real hard because, you know, these institutions are stacked against me. America is stacked against me. No use in me trying hard. We live in a racist society. It is racist. It's going to be racist. Well, Well, if that's, you know, if that's your feeling, you're not going to invest in yourself as much as you might otherwise invest if you think that there's hope. If you have the sense institutions are opening up, we value you, people like you, there's a place at the table for people like you. I think that it has actually, some people say that affirmative action has actually, you know, lessened people's incentives. I think it has actually increased people's incentives, increased the effort that people are willing to put forward. If you ask things like, well, you know, here's an issue that people don't like to talk about. Late 1960s, when affirmative action was sort of getting off the ground, you know, well, what was one of the things that was helping to lift it off the ground? One of the things that prompted affirmative action was the long, hot summers. I look out on this audience, there's some people here, I can just tell, who are of an age, they remember what was going on in the United States in the late 1960s, early 1970s. There were, you know, there were soldiers in the streets of American cities. There was that much discord. Well, there was a decision made, you know, this is dangerous. We have to open up our society, and not only open it up, but show that it's opened up in order to have a society in which, you know, people feel that, you know, people feel an investment. Diversity. I think there are many institutions that feel that they themselves get something out of having people from a wide variety of racial backgrounds so that they can educate one another. So these are some of the benefits, and I think that these benefits outweigh the costs, though I recognize the costs.
Let me put another cost on the table for discussion, and it's the one that now seems to be coming up most frequently when those oppose affirmative action, and it's called the mismatch theory. Mm-hmm. And Rick Sander, who's a professor here in Los Angeles at UCLA, is the primary architect of it. He says what affirmative action does is cause schools to take students who aren't of the caliber of the others in the class, so they tend to fall to the bottom of the class. If the top tier of law schools is taking students with affirmative action, those are students who really should have gone to the second and third tier of law schools, and they end up doing poorly, less likely to graduate, less likely to pass the bar than if they'd gone to the second and third tier that should be there. And the second and third tiers of law school are pulling up students from the fourth and fifth tier who shouldn't be there. And so if they'd gone to the fourth and fifth tier schools where they should be, they'd excel, but they fall to the bottom of the second and third tier, less likely to graduate, less likely to pass the bar. Sanders especially made the argument with regard to law schools because he's a law professor, but it's been generalized by others to education and other settings. What's your response to the mismatch argument?
I think that they have something of a point. That argument, by the way, has been around for a long time. It's true that Professor Sander, I think, has explored it in a deeper way than anyone else has, but another person familiar to Californians, Thomas Sowell, mm-hmm. has been pushing the mismatch theory for, you know, three decades, and you know, I think, is there something to it? Sure, there's something to it. That's why I say that I defend and champion. I don't just defend; I champion intelligent affirmative action, sensible affirmative action. Can affirmative action be done in a stupid way? Yes, of course. It's like any other program can be designed in a stupid fashion. And if affirmative action is done in a way that puts people in places where they're going to fail, well, that's, you know, that doesn't help anybody. That's bad. And to the extent that that's done, we need to, you know, reconfigure things. But do I think that that's characteristic? No. I think that, in fact, he exaggerates. I think he exaggerates what he views as a mismatch effect. And I also think that he very much undervalues the importance of elite institutions in American life. You take a look at the Supreme Court of the United States. The Supreme Court of the United States, every member on the Supreme Court of the United States went to two schools.
Right.
Two schools. Every member of the Supreme Court of the United States either went to Harvard Law School or went to Yale Law School.
To be careful here, I went to Harvard and he went to Yale Law School, so it shouldn't... I have to also admit to you, though, whenever
that,
I hear...
That might not be a good thing.
No, I don't think it is a good thing. Okay. I think there should be more diversity in the Supreme Court. I have to admit, whenever I hear the mismatch argument, I think of how much colleges and universities have always given preference to legacies. That if your parents went to a fancy college, university, you're more likely to be able to get in. I've never heard a parent say, I don't want my kid to be able to get into Princeton because of a mismatch concern.
Not only that, you know, I'm glad you said that. I mean, we're talking about affirmative action. The fact of the matter is, there are all sorts of policies that advance the interests of all sorts of groups. In my home state of Massachusetts, one of the most powerful affirmative action programs is an affirmative action program for veterans. Veterans are tremendously benefited in civil service competitions. Yeah, and by the way, when that was first proposed, it was tremendously controversial. It's not controversial at all now. Affirmative action in lots of states, very different standards for in-state students as opposed to out-of-state students. We have all sorts of policies which advance the interests of people. Every year, there are people who get, you know, the Mississippi River overflows its banks. People are flooded out. Who do they turn to? They turn to all of us for assistance. And it's granted. Why? Because we are all part of a polity, and we view it as our obligation to help those who are in need of assistance. Why is it that with respect to people of color, the argument gets ugly in a way that in other contexts it does not get ugly? And this goes back to what we were talking about when we first sat down. It's really too bad, but the fact of the matter is that we still live in a nation in which an appreciable number of people, let me rephrase that, a substantial number of people get really anxious in the face of any policy that they perceive as advancing people of color. It's really too bad, but it's true. And by the way, I am not saying that everybody who's against affirmative action is racist. I do not believe that. I want to be clear about that. But I am saying that there are a good many people who are against affirmative action who don't like it because they don't like the idea, frankly, of people of color advancing in our society.
What, though, of the argument that when you help some people of color, you're disadvantaging other people of color? And that's a very salient argument here in California, that the effect of giving benefits to African Americans and Latinos is to disadvantage Asian Americans.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In my view, any policy that engages in invidious racial discrimination ought to be outlawed. We ought not allow invidious racial discrimination.
Could you define that?
Yes.
Good. Will you define it?
Invidious racial discrimination is discrimination intended to put a group down, to stigmatize them, to signify that they are inferior. That is to say, invidious discrimination is the sort of discrimination that segregation was all about. It's not enough, in my view, to say that some policy disadvantages, it's not enough for somebody to come up to me and say a policy has disadvantaged me, therefore it's a discriminatory policy that should be outlawed. The fact of the matter is that there are all sorts of policies. I mean, what the heck? I mean, just suppose a school system says, we want to prefer people who are interested in pursuing mathematics as opposed to pursuing, let's say, English. That might have very systematic effects. In fact, I can imagine it having, you know, systematic effects on various groups. Should that be outlawed? Or let me give you another example, because I talk about this, and there are people who say, gosh, you know, Kennedy, you know, my people didn't Jim Crow your people. My people didn't enslave your people. My people just came here, you know, 10 years ago. Why should I have to be disadvantaged in this mission to, you know, overcome past racial oppression? And I say, well, you know, what about this? In 1988, the Congress of the United States passed the Civil Rights Act of 1988. In the Civil Rights Act of 1988, the Congress apologized to people of Japanese ancestry who were put in camps during World War II. And not only did the Congress do that, but the Congress also allocated money for reparations for people who were put in those camps. Well, I'm a tax-paying American. Uncle Sam reached into my pocket to pay the reparations. I was happy to pay the reparations. I'm part of the United States of America. And it was a terrible thing that the United States of America did, and it was a good thing that Congress finally, belatedly apologized, and it was a good thing that the United States government paid the reparations. I'm part of this thing called the United States of America. I get a lot of good things from it, and I should be called upon to do my bit to confront problems that confront us all. Well, the race line is still a problem in American life, and we should all do our bit to confront that problem. That's what I say to people.
One of the main arguments that's used against affirmative action is what you refer to as a call for colorblindedness. Mm-hmm. The argument is that the 14th Amendment, when it guarantees equal protection, really is a command that the government be colorblind. As you know, Chief Justice Roberts, in an opinion in 2007, said the best way to stop discriminating on the basis of race mm-hmm. is to stop discriminating on the basis of race, and said that we should be colorblind. Now, those who make this argument invoke the language of Martin Luther King. They invoke the language of the late Justice Harlan. You have a whole chapter in the book devoted to this. How do you respond to the colorblindness argument?
Yeah. Well, you know, especially with respect to, I'm a little bit touchy with respect to Martin Luther King. Because, we were just celebrating Martin Luther King, as we should, such a great man. But in the affirmative action controversy, Martin Luther King Jr. and his great I Have a Dream speech is often cited as an argument against affirmative action. You know, I dream for a day when people will be judged on the basis of their character and not on color. Let me read you something that Martin Luther King Jr. said in 1963. Our society has been doing something special against the Negro for hundreds of years. How then can he be absorbed into the mainstream of American life if we do not do something special for him now in order to balance the equation and equip him to compete on a just and equal basis? And I could give you a whole bunch of other quotations from Martin Luther King Jr. Martin Luther King Jr. had a realistic understanding of the difficulties of gaining equality in a society that has, for so long, subverted equality. And so it's, you know, I would say to the Chief Justice of the United States, Chief Justice Roberts, you're being simplistic. With respect to Chief Justice Roberts, with respect to Antonin Scalia, with respect to Clarence Thomas. If you listen to them, you would think that the Constitution of the United States said on its face that it is colorblind. It does not say that. The 14th Amendment of the Federal Constitution says that the states shall, or the 14th Amendment enjoins the states to provide all people with the equal protection of the law. Well, where's colorblindness in that? I would go on to say a couple of other things. The Constitution of 1787 said nothing about race. The Constitution of 1787 was colorblind. It also, by the way, of course, helped entrench racial slavery, but it was in formal terms colorblind. In fact, when does color, when does race enter into the Constitution of the United States? In Reconstruction, in the effort to transform a pigmentocracy into a multiracial democracy. That's when race is mentioned. So no, I'm hard on the colorblind argument. I end the chapter, by the way, saying that, you know, colorblindness is a trope that many people embrace, but it's an odd one because they're embracing a type of blindness. I mean, there are people who are, in fact, colorblind. You know, they can't distinguish, you know, pink from purple, from blue, from red. I don't think anybody should be happy about that. So why should we embrace, frankly, you know, a disability?
One of the things that I like so much in your historical chapter is one of the ironies is that the justices who most advance that the Constitution requires colorblindness are those who pride themselves on being originalists, who say that the meaning of the Constitution is limited to its original understanding. This is what Justices Scalia and Thomas say all the time. And yet they don't want to talk about the original understanding when it comes to the 14th Amendment. You show that the Congress that ratified the 14th Amendment did many things that were anything but colorblind.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that's interesting, here tonight you said what you're in favor of is sensible affirmative action. You wrote at one point in the book, I am in favor of sensibly designed affirmative action. I say that I support, you italicize, sensibly designed affirmative action. What do you mean by sensibly designed affirmative action?
I mean affirmative action that is thoughtful and that recognizes that it has costs, that it's attentive to those costs, and tries to minimize those costs. That's the sort of affirmative action that I support. I support affirmative action that is unafraid of reconsidering itself. You know, I'm a fan of affirmative action that recognizes that our society changes. I mean, the demographics of our society have changed, you know, considerably.
And so
we ought to be constantly thinking about, you know, who needs help? Who needs help? Maybe people who have needed help in the past don't need help anymore. Maybe people who have not been helped in the past, you know, need help. So I want an experimental mindset. I want a mindset that is very attuned to sociological realities. That's the sort of mindset that I have in mind.
The problem I have with that is it's very abstract. Let me make it more concrete.
Okay.
Imagine hypothetically I was the dean of a law school.
Okay.
And make it the dean of a law school in another state where there's not an initiative that prohibits affirmative action.
Okay.
And I come to you and I say, I really admire your book. I want to do sensible affirmative action for my law school. What should I do?
Read my book carefully.
Okay, I've done that.
Okay.
I promise.
Okay. I think you should consult best practices. The fact of the matter is we have all sorts of institutions across the United States. Some have been more successful than others. I think actually it would be a good thing to consult Professor Sander and Stuart Taylor's book on mismatch. You know, what are the places they think are the biggest offenders? What are the places they think are doing a good job? And, you know, see, what are the, you know, are there characteristics about the places that seem to be doing a job that's not so good? I mean, you know, be sociological. Face facts. And again, be unafraid. And after you do those things, proceed.
I want to talk in our last few minutes, we're opening up for questions, about the future of affirmative action. In 2003, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision in Grutter versus Bollinger, held that colleges and universities have a compelling interest in a diverse student body. College universities can use race as one factor among many in their admission decisions to benefit minorities. You discuss Grutter in great detail in the book. That was written by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, joined by Justices Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer. Well, the most important change in the Supreme Court since Grutter was Samuel Alito replacing Sandra Day O'Connor, and he doesn't share O'Connor's view. He's somebody who takes the John Roberts colorblindness approach. Can affirmative action survive with the Supreme Court?
Two things. Your reference to Justice O'Connor makes me... This is not directly responsive to your question, but I will get back
okay.
to it. You know, Sandra Day O'Connor is an interesting figure because prior to Grutter, she had been in the anti-affirmative action camp. And in fact, many people were very surprised about her vote and about her opinion. It's poetic justice, though. It's poetic justice. It's very fitting that Sandra Day O'Connor wrote the last big affirmative action opinion and that she voted to uphold affirmative action, in part because of her biography. And I think it's worth mentioning, and I think it's relevant to the question of the future of affirmative action. Who put Sandra Day O'Connor on the Supreme Court of the United
States?
Ronald Reagan, who was against affirmative action. He's running to be president of the United States. What does he say? This guy who's against affirmative action says that if he becomes president of the United States, he will appoint a woman to the Supreme Court. That's what he says. Mm-hmm. He will appoint the best woman jurist he can find. And he does. He carries through on his promise. Now, I think that's relevant to the future of affirmative action in a variety of ways. One way in which it's relevant is, I don't care what the Supreme Court does with respect to affirmative action, the affirmative action ethos will live, no matter what the Supreme Court says. Because even people who say they're against affirmative action, actually want it to a large degree. Here's this guy, Mr. Republican, Mr. Conservative, Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan came to the point of view that, you know, we simply cannot have a Supreme Court that doesn't have a woman on it. It doesn't feel right. It doesn't look right. It's not right. And he's not alone. He's not alone in that. Every president since Lyndon Johnson has had at least one black person in the cabinet. Is that accidental? No, it's not accidental. You know, people use the term quota, you know, scare word, quota. We have had an unspoken quota at the level of presidential cabinet since Lyndon Johnson. If Patrick Buchanan had become president of the United States, he would have found a black person to put in the cabinet. Why? because he would have said, and you know, he's, you know, I'm against affirmative action, I'm against affirmative action, I'm against quotas, blah, blah, blah. He would have said, you know, it's absolutely, it's just intolerable to have public, highly public, key institutions of American life that are devoid of important sectors of our society. That is a good thing, and it's that feeling. And by the way, the Republican Party for a long time has had an anti-affirmative action plank in its platform. You wouldn't know it when they have their presidential conventions. You wouldn't know it. You see plenty of people of color. Why? Because this group, this party, that at one level is anti-affirmative action, at another level feels it to be imperative to show that, you know, we're open. And frankly, that feeling is a good thing. And I think that it will continue no matter what.
Yeah, but you're implying with that answer is it really doesn't matter what the Supreme Court does. And on that, I can't agree with you. Having lived in California and seeing the effects of Proposition 209, if the Supreme Court were to say that affirmative action violates the Constitution, colorblindness required, it would have a dramatic effect. And that's why I ask you, what do you think the Supreme Court's going to do given the change in the composition?
The Supreme Court of the United States, it does matter. Sure, it matters. What I meant to say was, let's suppose that the Supreme Court of the United States did what the Fifth Circuit did a number of years ago in Texas. A number of years ago, University of Texas had an affirmative action plan. It was challenged. Fifth Circuit struck it down. Can't use race. What happened after that? Very interesting thing happened. The Texas legislature, no rip-roaring liberal legislature we're talking about. The Texas legislature, knowing that without taking race into account, the numbers of Latinos, the numbers of blacks was going to go down dramatically and precipitously. The Texas legislature, what did it do? It said, we've got to do something. They created what they call the top 10% plan. So in Texas, if you're in the top 10% of your class, no matter where you are, you get an automatic entry into the University of Texas system. So if you're in the top 10%, and I'm choosing my school names advisedly here, I think you'll see what I'm talking about. If you're in the top 10% of, let's say, Robert E. Lee High School, you get in. And if you're in the top 10% of, let's say, Booker T. Washington, you get in. That is supposed to be, and is, in fact, it's considered race neutral. And so the conservative justices say, oh, that's okay. Well, you know, it's a euphemism. It is, in fact, race conscious. They would never have passed that but for their knowledge of the racial demographic consequences of that law. So in my view, it's race conscious. If the Supreme Court of the United States was to strike down racial affirmative action, the sort of thing that happened in Texas would happen all over the United States. In other words, affirmative action, it would be constrained, but the affirmative action ethos would continue.
Let me take you to today. The book essentially ends with the decision that came down from the Supreme Court on Monday, June 24th, Fisher versus University of Texas at Austin. And there the Supreme Court said, and it was a 7-1 decision, that colleges and universities have a compelling interest in a diverse student body, but they have to prove, in order to use race, that no race-neutral alternative can achieve diversity. Mm-hmm. And the court sent back the Texas case to the Court of Appeals to give the University of Texas the chance to show that no race-neutral alternative could achieve diversity. Mm-hmm. How does a college or university go about proving that? What will be enough to meet that test? Mm-hmm.
I don't know. And I think that, and I don't mind saying I don't know. I mean, and frankly, I don't, you know, I think that the Supreme Court's jurisprudence with respect to this issue is woefully deficient. And it's very unclear what one would have to show. So I don't know.
Well, let me ask you one last question, then we'll open it up. One of the questions that's always raised about affirmative action is the how long question. Mm-hmm. In fact, in Grutter, Justice O'Connor said, well, I think this for another 25 years. And the only basis I can think of that she had 25 years in number, it had been 25 years since the Bakke case until the Grutter case. And then there's a discussion among the justices as whether that 25-year figure was binding or not. But there is an underlying question. How long, if we're going to have affirmative action, should it continue to exist?
You know, there are a variety of responses one could give. I suppose one might say, we'll know when we don't need racial affirmative action, when we can go into the place where they take newborns in a hospital. You know, we can go to the place where they take newborns, and you can say, you know, I cannot make a confident judgment about the risk of this kid being incarcerated. I cannot make a confident judgment about the possibility of this person becoming president of the United States or a senator or a governor or a chief executive officer. I cannot make a confident, you know, I can't take race into account and make confident risk analysis, or, you know, I can't chart their trajectory. When that happens, when the importance of race has withered away so much that you can go into a hospital and say, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. That might be a response. Or there's a second one that I have in mind, which is, you know, there was a time when there was a Jewish seat on the Supreme Court of the United States. So Brandeis was the first Jew on the Supreme Court of the United States, and then he was followed by Felix Frankfurter, and then, I don't know, you know, Goldberg, Fortas. There was a Jewish seat for, you know, good for a while. You know, sort of, again, an unspoken quota. And then that ran out. And there was a period of time when there were no Jews on the Supreme Court of the United States. And every now and again, somebody would mention it, but it ceased to be a point of anxiety. It was, you know, people might note it, but it ceased to be a point of anxiety. And there was a certain relaxation. You know, no, there's no Jews on the Supreme Court right now, or Jews, but, you know, that, you know, okay, but, you know, it'll happen again. You know. Well, I suppose there might come a time, and I think, in fact, I'm in the optimistic camp of American race relations. I think there will come a time when there will be a certain relaxation, when the society has been transformed such that the absence of a black person in the presidential cabinet doesn't give rise to, you know, a tremendous amount of anxiety. It's at that point that, you know, we might be able to do without affirmative action. In other words, it's a long time from now.
My grandmother used the expression, she really did, from your lips to God's ears. Why don't we now shift? I have so many more questions I'd love to ask you, but why don't we get questions from the audience? And they're going to walk around with microphones and take the questions. They'll bring the microphones to you.
Have to get up. Professor, you emphasized a feeling of stigma as a law professor at Harvard. I can attest to the fact that I've had several hundred students who've read your Race, Crime, and the Law and find it a model of scholarship. They keep on asking me why you don't update it. It's 1996, and I say it does not have to be updated. I am concerned, however, that in your chapter on racial profiling, you tell me that, and you tell your readers, that race discrimination requires strict scrutiny, a compelling governmental interest. And now you're emphasizing a balancing, that affirmative action can be supported by a balancing argument that the benefits outweigh the liabilities, and I wonder why the change. That's question number one.
Let's do question number one only, because I want to let other people get questions.
No, I haven't reached my question, and I have several for
you. I'm going to actually use the prerogative of the moderator and let Randy answer that question. Then I want others to get their questions, too.
Yeah, but I'm concerned about a sensible affirmative action. Does it extend, as it does, to Tongans, people from the Mariana Islands, as it does, people from India, people from Kiribati?
Gotcha.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. With respect to your first question, first of all, I'm really happy that you used the book, and I'm glad the students like it. I stand by much of what I wrote in that book, but I don't stand by everything that I wrote in that book. I think you've put your finger on something. I've changed my mind with respect to certain things. If I was going to redo that book, it would be I would have some real considerable revisions. And so my way of viewing racial distinctions is different now than when I wrote that book in 1997. With respect to your second question about sensible affirmative action, I think I said in my colloquy with the dean here that I'm perfectly willing to consider all sorts of people. I want to bring in all sorts of people, and I think that in various contexts, if we're in a situation where we have a group that is on the margins of society and we want to make sure that we bring that group in, by all means, people from India, people from anywhere, should be embraced by affirmative action. And I see no reason in principle why anybody should be excluded from affirmative action benefits, including white people in various contexts. I mean, one of the benefits of the diversity rationale for affirmative action is that everybody can at least theoretically advance the purposes of diversity. So, white people, I know white kids who want to go to historically black institutions and put in their application materials, "I'm white. You don't have that many people like me." So actually, when you're trying to fill up your class, you should give, you should look on my application with more solicitude than, this other person. You got a lot of black people. Look at me more closely.
Next question.
What do you think the next segment of American society, if any, would be to push for affirmative action, aside from African Americans in universities, to push for affirmative action enough to push legislation?
I think affirmative action has been, in fact, one of the things that has, there are all sorts of groups that have pushed strongly for affirmative action. Women have pushed strongly for affirmative action. In fact, one of the arguments against affirmative action is that so many groups have pushed for affirmative action that it's no longer a program for minorities. When you have one argument is that in fact affirmative action has been enlisted by too many groups, that it has been to that some extent diluted, and that if you get so many people involved in affirmative action, it becomes more of a sort of situation in which groups are feathering their nests as opposed to really doing something that will advance the fortunes of the society as a whole. So we already have a situation in which, you know, frankly, any group that thinks it can benefit from affirmative action pushes for affirmative action. So, you know, I mean, Italians in New York State long ago were pushing for affirmative action. All sorts of groups have pushed for affirmative action. And in my view, fine.
Hello, Mr. Kennedy. First of all, thank you so very much for spending your evening with us. You do amazing work, and thank you so much. My question, well, sort of very, very short story. I was just invited to the Gambia, West Africa, last year by the president there. And the very first time, as an African-American, a bona fide African-American, that means all the history I can go back to the 1800s, have been in Columbia, South Carolina, where you're from, and Georgia. Sorry, it's Georgia. And there, you know, I began to put a large body of work together of paintings called the Cotton Series, the Place of Reference, which is why I ended up in Africa. While in Africa, it dawned on me the poison, the rooted poison, and the problems at referring to our ancestors as slaves, when in fact, all of that beautiful country that after that long cruise, that free cruise, and how do you feel about changing the vernacular on that word, slaves, that our ancestors are slaves, and they were indeed enslaved Africans?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I see the point. I mean, because if you say that people were slaves, and, I mean, I guess in a certain sort of way, you are acceding to their status as slaves. And you might take the position that no one is rightly enslaved, and so they ought not be termed slaves. I understand that point. I think it's a nice point. I also think, however, that most people understand that these people who were called slaves were subordinated, were oppressed unjustly. And so, you know, I think it's a nice point you make. I think it's a point that ought to be articulated. At the same time, I don't think that when, you know, you read a book and you read on the page that there were, at the time, in 1865, 4 million slaves in the United States, I don't feel that the writer is insulting people. I don't feel that the writer is perpetuating, you know, oppression, because I understand what the writer is saying.
Thank you both. This is wonderful. Professor Kennedy, you're at Harvard. Clarence Thomas is on the Supreme Court. How would you be willing to describe to me the divergence of opinion on the matter of affirmative action?
Mm-hmm. You know, African Americans are it's a large group, large community, and African Americans vary tremendously in perspective, vary tremendously in, you know, religious beliefs, cultural beliefs, ideological beliefs. Justice Clarence Thomas is extremely conservative culturally. He's extremely conservative politically. Therefore, I differ with him radically. But, you know, if you go through the history of the United States, one ought not be surprised by that. In every era, there have been strong disagreements among black Americans. So, you know, I disagree with them, but I'm not surprised that there would be, you know, African Americans. There's a considerable number of African Americans who, you know, differ on this issue and differ on lots of issues.
Please.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor Kennedy and Professor Chemerinsky. I came to this meeting this evening wondering which way I lean more in terms of affirmative action. Is it more of an ideal or ethos, as you referred to it, or is it more of an intervention, a way to right past wrongs? And I came thinking that I probably lean toward the ideal side of that. It is an American ideal that, as you put it, a sensible affirmative action is, as a society, being in that mode of being constantly sensitive to the shifting needs of Mosaic of America. Mm-hmm. So because of that, your last answer made me not fully satisfied, that there may come a time, perhaps there should come a time when we should no longer be anxious about what we don't see. And I wonder if we shouldn't always be anxious and sensitive. Mm. And so in that sense, affirmative action is an American mode of being as a society rather than an interventional program. And how would you respond to that?
I think it's a very interesting idea. Most of the time, I suppose, or as a general matter, I see it, and I've spoken of it and I've thought about it as a vehicle, a policy. It's a vehicle that is attempting to get us to a better place. Now, I think that, you know, your comment, I think, is an interesting comment, because when you could it be that we should it be the case that we hold open the possibility that we always want to be in a state of perpetual creation and recreation, and that maybe it's wrong to actually aspire for a particular end state, as opposed to leaving open, you know, we're going to have a fluid society, we have a general aspiration, but we don't want to make our boundaries too close. We don't want to develop an ideal in our mind that's too set, because maybe doing that closes off our imaginations to various possibilities. I think that's a very interesting point. I need to
two
think
more
a little bit more about
two last questions.
Professor Kennedy, you spoke about the composition of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah.
The current Supreme Court is made up of 6 Roman Catholics and 3 Jews. In the interest of affirmative action and diversity, do you think the next vacancy should be filled by a Protestant?
Yeah. There are a lot of people who think that and actually are saying exactly that. I suppose that and, you know, maybe this just, you know, is a index of my own secularism. I wouldn't say the next appointee needs to be a Protestant. I heard somebody out there say something about, you know, what about an atheist? Okay. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, this sort of goes back to my comment about the seats. It's interesting that though people talk about that a bit, it has not emerged as a burning public issue. You know, people talk about it a little bit, but it has not emerged as a burning public issue because I think that to a large extent, it would have at one time been a burning public issue. But now it's not because I think in various ways which are very hard to quantify, we have a certain relaxed view toward those sorts of boundaries. And I think that at some point in the future, we might very well have a relaxed view with respect to racial boundaries, though that's far, far in the future.
Our last question.
Thank you very much for coming here. I just wanted to know if you would what policies you'd recommend to fix public education areas where lower income isn't even an issue, maybe, if you could address that. Thank you.
Yeah. In a minute or less.
You know, I don't mind saying at all that certain things are outside of my jurisdiction. I think that the thing that you put your finger on is deeply, deeply, deeply important. I mean, the fact of the matter is that so often we focus attention on policies that, frankly, are late in the game. I mean, you might very well say, gosh, wouldn't it be better instead of, trying to fix things at the end of 12 years of education or more. What about making it so that we don't have to engage in any sort of remedial catch-up? And indeed, we ought not have to engage in remedial catch-up. And so this question of K through 12 is deeply, deeply important. We need to focus much more attention on it than we do. Exactly what we should do, I don't know, but I'm sure that there are really smart people out there writing books, and when those people are invited to come here, we should all come, and we should all be as attentive as you all have been this evening.
Thank you all so much for coming. Randy.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.